Let's go to Exodus chapter 36. And verse 31. Actually, 35.
Yeah, that looks better.
It's mislabeled in this book. Said, and make a veil of blue. It's called, that is a color called tekelet, and purple, and scarlet, and a fine linen worked with an article design, an artistic design of the cherubim, the cherubim. Said, and he made it for the pillars of the acacia wood and overlaid it with gold and the hooks of the grate and cast four sockets for them. Okay, this is what this curtain is, a curtain that goes into the, is the separation from the holy place in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, into the Holy of Holies. Its name in Hebrew is parochet. It's significant, but you don't have to worry about that, but it's called a parochet. It's a veil. Now, one of the things that you should understand out of this particular verse is that there is an approach, a way to approach God, a way to come closer to God. And sometimes people try to let the mechanics get in the way. And so when the mechanics get in the way, then you try to get closer to God, but I have to do this, I have to do that. You go down the list of all the details of the things that you want to do, okay? But as we've been talking over the past several weeks, the idea of what we're trying to understand is, number one, to know God. And if we want to know God, then last week we said there are what we call veils in place, okay? So one of the veils that we have to deal with is, you know, the veil of physicality. And so that becomes something that can separate us or put a barrier between ourselves and God, okay? But that said, the idea of the veils is in purpose for a lot of different reasons. Some of which we'll discuss in the future, but nothing that we need to discuss at the absolute present, okay? So that being said, here you have this idea presented in the construction of the Mishkan, okay? The Mishkan means the tabernacle that was in the wilderness, okay? But Mishkan, it has a very important idea in me. In the M in Hebrew basically has the idea of from, like from some place or whatever. So from there to here, you might say. And in this case, Mishkan, Shekan in Hebrew, and especially in contemporary Hebrew, means neighbor. And so your neighbor is Shekan, the guy that lives next door to you. That being said, you know, the essence of the word literally means that God wants to come from where he's at and be your neighbor. Neighbor, and the idea is literally to, and, you know, if you read back a few chapters and read that story, he says, you know, I want them to build a sanctuary for me so that, you know, I can come and I can visit with them and I can, you know, deal with them. And inside of the Holy of Holies, it's really, really difficult, and here's why, okay? So you have a room that, let's just say for the sake of argument, that it's a 10 by 10 room, okay? And then you have this veil. It's not a veil, it's two veils, Okay, and that also is, you know, a difficulty because you got a room 10 by 10. And it's all of the dimensions of the ark, or excuse me, of the tabernacle. When you have them, they're supposed to all, you know, come up to a certain number. So if you have, you know, a 10 by 10 area with a 2-foot strip in between the two curtains, it should be 12 feet, right? Or whatever the number is. It's not there. Okay, so it just says 10 by 10. So either that means that you know, the 10 by 10 starts out at the edge of the curtain, or, you know, there's a difficulty. And so then the scholars go on and they start to talk about, you know, what's inside of the Holy of Holies. And what's inside of the Holy of Holies is what we call the Aron Kodesh, or the Ark of the Covenant, okay? The Ark of the Covenant is a design. It's a like a rectangular box. And inside of that rectangular box, it was originally designed to house two cubes. And the cubes were to be what we would consider about an 18-inch square cube. And so there was to be two of them. They were to be sapphire, and they were to be written with the finger of God. Okay? Now they're called Lukot in Hebrew. And when God originally created them, he created them out of a piece of material that existed like before creation. So he creates them out of these two cubes, and the cubes are, again, sapphire, so pure that you can almost literally see through them. So what you would be looking at is a blue stone of sorts, or a stone that's almost clear with a bluish hue as you would look through it. And it would almost look a little bit like a holographic image. And so as you look at it, there are letters, and of course this is written from right to left like Hebrew, and you say it's backwards. No, everything else is backwards. It's correct. Okay? Why? Because it's written with the hand of God. Okay? So, that being said, the two cubes were written, but they were written, and on every side of the cube, there was writing. And so, on the writing, God had written not just the commandments, but what we understand and consider to be the whole Torah. Okay, the first five books of Moses. Now, the interesting thing is, when you also looked at the cubes, the letters went all the way through the cubes. So if you were looking at the cube, and you were looking through it, and you had a light on the back, the light would shine through the cube from the other side.
Kind of like one of those tunnel lights.
Something of that essence, but the interesting thing is, you know, if you have a letter on this side and you look on it on the other side, it would appear to be backwards, right? And, you know, so then you would think that, well, on the other side, you know, what's written is the very same thing, only it's in reverse. Well, in the ideology of these two cubes, when you look at it and it's you can see clear through it, then when you get on the other side, there's something written there, and it's whatever continues the idea of what's in the cube, okay? So these were called Lukot, and they were two of them. And that's not because there was so much material that it took two of them to write on the cubes. That means they were identical, okay? So when you go to the car lot to buy a car, and you decide that you want a car, you make a contract, and when you sign the contract, what happens? You get a copy of the contract, okay? So this is the essence of the two different cubes. One cube is for us, one cube is for God. Now, the difficulty is that when Moses, when he was going up on the mountain, and when he was on the mountain, he was up there communing with God, and as he communed with God, he told told Moses, okay, you know, now it's time to go and share the cubes with the B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. So he goes down the mountain. He's partially down the mountain, and they hear a sound, and he says, Joshua is with him, Yehoshua, and he says, it sounds like there's the sound of war. And so they're kind of in a frenzy to get down, and when they get down, you have the children of Israel that are worshiping the golden calf. Okay, Moses is so outraged that he breaks those two cubes, and they're shattered into, you know, however many pieces. You can imagine dropping a piece of glass or a glass jar or something like that, and then trying to recover all the fragments, okay? But that said, you know, the idea behind these cubes, later Moses has to rewrite the cubes. He writes the cubes. And there is a way as well that on the stones of the high priest, the letters of the tribes or the names of the tribes were written on each one of those stones. So one was for Reuben, one was for et cetera, okay? But they could not use a tool that was made of metal to do it. They couldn't use a chisel or something like that to make the engraving on the stone. And so they actually used a worm, and the worm had some acidic properties to it, and when it would move across the stone, the name of the tribe would be written on that stone. So then the question goes back to, they could not use an instrument of metal to write on the stone. Anybody have an idea why?
Because it was man-made.
It's a man-made thing, okay. Metal, during those times, even today, was one of the things that was used as a weapon. Okay? So you can't, on the things of God, you cannot use something that man made can be used as a weapon. And so, for this reason, they had figured out how, and it's still a mystery today, and that is with many of the colors that are discussed here in this. And we discussed those a little bit on Sabbath. And one of the colors is blue, it says. And it actually in Hebrew is called the word tehelet. And tehelet is a dye that is made from a mollusk or a snail. Okay? That dye that is made is supposed to be a very, very dark blue. And so, you know, the formula and the method for creating this color was lost for millennia, thousands of years, literally, at least 2,000 years, okay? So they knew that the mollusk would show up on the shore of the Mediterranean, you know, against Israel, and they knew that, you know, this mollusk was the one that would be the one to produce this color. So you have all of these Israeli scientists that are trying to figure out how in the world that they're going to make this color, because it's supposed to be the color that goes on the fringe. And so they're trying to make this color. They want to know this color and make the color, but they don't have a clue how to make it. So the scientists are working in their laboratory, and they've tried all these different methods, and they can't figure it out. So one day, you know, Moshe comes in and he says to Aaron or Yehoshua, he says, come on, let's go to lunch. And he said, no, he said, I got this you know, beaker, and it's got the snail and it's got the, you know, color in it, and I'm trying to figure out how to do this. He goes, it'll be here when we get back. Come on, let's go have lunch. And so the guy says, okay. And he puts the beaker in the window. And so they go to have lunch, and they come back, and lo and behold, inside of the beaker is this brilliant blue. And they're just, you know, fascinated. at the fact that, you know, somehow miraculously it seems to have manifest, you know, in the process of all this stuff. Well, of course, what happens is that the sunlight causes the color to turn blue. Now, it's very, very interesting, coincidental, of course, that the light is measured in what we call rads. Okay, and so the scientists, you know, after they've got the color, they want to know how in the world it really happened. And what they find out, that there are a certain number of rads of sunlight that it takes to make this color. So that means it can't just be at any time of the day. It has to be at a very certain time of the day when this happens. And it just happens to be somewhere around noon. But the number of rads of light that it takes is 613, which is the same exact number as the number of the commandments.
Yeah,
yeah, purely coincidental. Okay. That said, there are many things like this that happen. And another image just out of this thing, we also talked about this on Shabbat, but nevertheless, the color red or scarlet, it is made by another worm, and not a mollusk, but a worm. And what happens is, the mother worm is going to have baby worms, and so what she does is she has sort of a like a beak, more or less, almost like, say, a bird or something like that. But she basically nails herself into the base of a tree, and she burrows and then holds on to that tree to where she's attached to the tree, and then she sheds a protective layer over the top of her babies, and it's scarlet red. So, or let's say it's probably about the same color as blood. So, did you see the image? Okay, it's an image of the Messiah on the cross. Okay, so all of these things are trying to tell us that there are doors, gates, passageways, occupations. There are many different things that are passageways to be able to see or know God. Okay, so if you were to go to the tabernacle, which you could not, you could go to the outer court of the tabernacle, but there were designated people who functioned inside of the tabernacle, which were priests, etc. And the priests were the ones who could enter and go into the various courts. But only the priest, the high priest, could go into the Holy of Holies. And he only did that one time a year, and that was on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Now, one of the things about a lot of people that don't understand the idea of atonement is that they think, you know, that when you go through Yom Kippur, there's this great big question of whether we got forgiven this year or not. But it's amazing, after over 3,500 years of having a tabernacle, having a temple, and having no temple, and all of this, that every year God forgives us of our sins. So that means really that that day is not just one of the holiest days, it's one of the most beautiful days. Even though we fast on that day, the beauty of it is that we'll always have God's forgiveness, okay?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Is it true that when the priests went into the Holy of Holies, they would tie a rope around his head?
That is a myth.
Okay.
And part of the reason why we know that it's a myth, first of all, there's absolutely no information in the construction of the temple or the tabernacle or any of those things with regards to the fact that, you know, this guy was supposed to die inside of the Holy of Holies and then you'd have to drag him out and whatever. That was the whole idea behind tying a rope behind his ankle. And I think also that it would basically violate a principle called faith, right? Because this guy's supposed to go in and he's supposed to do his job, and the idea is that God's going to forgive. So if you tie a rope to his ankle and you send him into the Holy of Holies, you're saying that he may not forgive us, or that, you know, I'm not really at the level to be in God's presence. And so if that were the case, then everyone that tied the rope to his ankle would have to be drug out, right?
Right. Besides, God knows whether he's worthy to go in there to begin with anyway.
Okay, but the conclusion of that story is that God didn't kill you on that day. Okay.
I just read it somewhere.
It's commonly thought as a thing, and it develops in Christianity, not in Judaism. Judaism knows better. Only because, you know, they're, you know, intimately acquainted with the construction of the temple and the tabernacle, etc. Okay. But what happens is later in the year, maybe tomorrow, maybe a week from now, the priest mysteriously dies. And even if they had an autopsy, they wouldn't be able to determine exactly why this guy died. Okay. So there were years when that happened. And there were years when 2 or 3 years in a row, the guys died. Okay. Now, one of the things that is connected to that is the fact that the high priests in the first century, not when the tabernacle was first or the tabernacle was built in the wilderness, nor when the Temple of Solomon was created, but in the first century, what happened is that through the conflict that existed between the different sects of Judaism, the different diversions, S-E-C-T, sect. And so when they were in the time of the New Testament, all the priests were Sadducees. And this is a real conundrum. Why? Because the Sadducee doesn't believe in spirituality. No spirituality whatsoever. So he thinks it's eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we're going to die. And so they were what is called an Epicurean. And that's the Epicurean philosophy. It's all about happiness right now. So let's live, drink, and let's whatever. And there is no afterlife. Okay? So it's very curious. But nevertheless, what would happen on Yom Kippur is that the other side, the side that was truly spiritual, the Pharisees, would take the high priest and sequester him for 7 days and drill him and make sure he performed the ceremony exactly the way they had to be.
So the Sadducees were the ones that were responsible for the Messiah's crucifixion, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And it's a very difficult thing to understand, but the fundamental is on Passover, it has to be kept on a certain day. I mean, it's written in the Bible, but the description, here's the problem, okay? When we read the Bible and we know that the day doesn't start at morning or at midnight, as, you know, most of the world, you know, that's how they do it. But in Judaism, the day starts at sunset, okay? This is based on Genesis 1 and 5. It said, in the evening and the morning were the first day, okay? So the evening comes first, and then the morning comes next, and then that makes or constitutes a whole day, okay? So obviously on Friday night, we light the candles at sunset or just before sunset, okay? So that being said, what happened was there's a difference in the time and the day when the Sadducees and the Pharisees kept Passover. The Sadducees kept it a day early, and the Pharisees kept it exactly on the date that it was biblically mandated to do, according to that idea of the evening and the morning. Okay, Yeshua was crucified. And he was crucified on the day when, just after the Sadducees had kept the Passover. But now, on the day he's crucified, all the Pharisees are keeping Passover. Now, what that the answer that that gives us is that all the business, all the trial that Yeshua went through and all of that stuff, number one, it was not a legal court. It wasn't a legal Jewish court. That's why they had to take him to the Romans. And the Romans, of course, they crucified him, which in Judaism, there's no such thing as crucifixion. You don't punish somebody with crucifixion. You either behead them, you stone them, or, you know, some other form of punishment, okay? So Yeshua was crucified on the cross. What was his crime? What was...
King of the Jews.
Said he was the king of the Jews. How in the world is that a crime?
It was against the Roman government.
It's against Roman law, not Jewish law. So, you know, nobody was going to stand up and say they were the, quote, king of the Jews, which really was a synonym for Messiah.
So the Sadducees knew that the Pharisees were celebrating Passover.
And then, so let's do it this way, because,
etc. They'll all be busy.
They'll be busy, they won't be able to do anything, okay? Okay, so the veils, this shows us in Exodus, it shows us a principle that there's always going to be a path of some sort that we have to follow, that we go down in order to have our meeting with God. Now, the interesting thing about the construction of the tabernacle is that what it does is it shows us that there, excuse me, there is a path, there is a process, okay? So when we stop and basically look at the construction of the tabernacle, there's a curtain that goes all the way around the tabernacle, okay? So there's room on the outside to walk all the way around the tabernacle, but then you have the core of the tabernacle. So there's a courtyard outside of what is called the court of the priest, or a court of the Jewish men. And then there's the court of the Jewish men. Then there's the holy court. Then inside, it's literally an outer court. Then inside of the tabernacle, there's a place called the holy place. And then you move beyond that and you go to what is considered the Holy of Holies.
And there's the court of the women too, before you get to the court.
The court of the women is outside of the court of
the men.
And it's very easily shown when you're looking at the temple. The temple has, if you see a picture of it, and I can show you a picture next week. But if you see the picture of the temple, that it has four large buildings that are on the, basically like the entrance to go into the temple. And in that court is the court of the women. Then there's a porch, and the porch has 15 different steps. And that is the court of the men, but it just barely goes into the edge of the courtyard area. And then you have the altar of sacrifice. And once you get just past that court of the men, that's the court of the priests, where all the priests work. And then you go inside, and into the Holy of Holies. Those veils are standards or methods whereby we approach God. Okay, so the idea is that you can't just be, you know, the guy that murdered, you know, 500 people and then turn around and say, "Hi, God, how you doing this morning? You know, I love you very much." It doesn't make any sense. And the other thing is that even in you know, people that are not murderers or whatever, but, you know, you act ugly to somebody, you do something wrong, and there's no condemnation here. It's just, you know, if something of negativity happens in your life, you know, then the idea is that, you know, before you enter God's presence, you need to get rid of that, okay? But God has made it to where that is possible. That was one of the conditions that he made before he made the physical world. He made a thing called repentance. So when you're sorry or you realize that you've done something that is going to be a barrier, a veil between you and God. Yeah, that's
as best a picture as I can see right
now. Yeah, I'll set it up next week to where you can see a really good picture. So that being said, you know, again, there's a veil. And that veil is basically sin in and of itself that keeps us from entering into the presence of God. So we need to rid ourselves of this thing. Okay, so last week what we talked about was the first veil being the veil of the lie. Okay, and the veil of the lie was what was handed or given down to or given to Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve. And that veil is still in place to this very day. And it's the first veil that you and I have to deal with in a way to try to rid ourselves of any type of negativity so that we can enter into the presence of God. Okay, but one of the things you should also know, in the process of all of this creation where that you have a serpent that is trying to entice Adam and Chava to do the wrong thing, you have what is called the Sitra Achra, and that's the other side, the side of negativity, okay? And that is because by this time, by the time that Adam and Eve are in the garden, the light bearer has already fallen, okay? Or his title, not his name. His title is Lucifer. Lucifer just means a light bearer, okay? So there's another light bearer now, and you could say that he's Lucifer, but that, again, that's just a title. That is not a wickedness. It doesn't mean that he was wicked. Lucifer became wicked, and then he was cast down, okay? The book of Revelation says these spirits have been held in chains of darkness. Doesn't that sound quite apropos? You got a being that's supposed to being a being of light, and because he fell, because he did the wrong thing or whatever, he does what? God puts them in chains of darkness, okay? Yeah, as a punishment, absolutely. You know, if you're intended function is to radiate the glory of God, and then you sin against that, then there's no radiating the divine presence or the glory of God, okay? Okay, so with this is when sin enters the world, not when Adam sins. Adam follows suit and does something wrong. He rebels against God. The light bearer fell because he refused to do his job. In Jude, there's only one chapter, but in verse 6, it tells you, said some of the original angels didn't keep their station. They didn't remain faithful to their job, so they fell. Okay, and that falling brought contamination into the cosmos. Adam had the choice to follow God, do what God asks, etc., or he could rebel, and he rebelled. There are various reasons why all of that took place, not this morning's discussion, but he accepted that contamination onto himself. And us. Okay,
so God still took care of them even after they were out of the garden.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's an interesting thing that happens. The word light in Hebrew is called Or, and if you know the Hebrew alphabet, it starts with an Aleph, which is the very first letter of the alphabet. And then it uses the sixth letter out of the alphabet called the Vav. And that just makes the U sound. And then the letter, Hebrew letter R, which is resh, and that's or. And they first were translucent beings of light, Adam and Chava. So they radiated light very much like the angels. But then it says that God made them skins of ore. And you think, well, that means that he made them skins to cover their body, but the body allowed the skins that they wore would allow the light to radiate. But it's interesting, there are two letters in the Hebrew alphabet that will allow you to spell that word. Okay? The first word with the aleph, the first letter of that, aleph means it's a synonym for the name Elohim. And then Elohim starts with that letter. But the coats that of skin that he made for them were or, and that was the letter ayin. And ayin basically is a letter that means nothing. So you cover somebody's being up that's supposed to radiate and you put an ayin on it means no light. Okay, so they didn't have a light radiating from them in that. But at the same time, there's a picture here of, you know, how we are to manifest God's presence in the world. And that manifestation comes through the clothes. Okay? So it doesn't matter what you wear, your clothes are an image of who you are. And in the essence, the clothes, they say the clothes makes the man or whatever they say, however that cliche goes. But the idea here is that the idea to radiate the divine inside of you through the clothes, okay? So they were well taken care of. There's no question about that. But this is why I say that in the end times, the times that we will really be getting to know God, what's going to happen is things are going to change. And when the things change, we will be able to experience what Adam and Chava had inside of the garden, okay? And Adam and Eve experienced God's presence in the garden, the divine presence in the garden. And it's interesting when it says that God came to them to speak with them. It doesn't say they saw God or that they heard God. It said they heard his voice, okay? And that means they knew his voice. They knew when and how to communicate with him, but he was there and they hid themselves in with fig leaves. Why fig leaf? Fig is a great big leaf and it helps, you know, for the process of first camouflage ever. Among the trees, you start to see, you know, how camouflage works. Okay? So it was in the Bible before it was anywhere. All right, so it says that he came, his voice came, and it says that he came in the cool of the day. And that word, cool, is the Hebrew word for spirit, ruach. So there was a time, and in this context, it means the breathing out. So when a person is giving a lecture, he's breathing out words. And he's breathing out, you know, the testimonies of God, etc. Okay? So Adam and Eve experienced first the first veil, and they experienced this contamination and this separation from God. But God has, again, always had a part of the construction of the cosmos, repentance. And so it's simple enough. If Adam and Chava want to have a relationship with God, all they have to do is repent. Okay? And there is a mechanism that is shown in the process of them receiving these skins. Okay? And the skins that even though they cover the body and they cover the light, that is the process of atonement. Okay? Then that means that the veil that gives us the greatest amount of obstruction so that we can't see God is the flesh, the physical body. And so, you know, it's like if I could just unzip this and come out for a few minutes, I could talk with God, okay? So it's sort of like that so that you can understand that. And then, as we talked last week, there are five different levels of the soul. The soul, those levels constitute the next levels of the veils. So you need to remove each one of those veils so that after you've removed each of those veils, then you can move forward and then you can come closer to contacting God, having a communication with God. Now, one of the things you should understand, no matter how much spirituality that you've experienced in your life to this very point, there's always more. In God, there's infinitely so much more. So this process of removing the veils is a process that what it tries to do is show us the fact, and the looking at the curtain, that there's a way to do this. Now, as we do it, you know, we learn that the first problem is the body, okay? And so the things that can be done in the body that are negative are obstructions and we don't see God. But we should never think that the body is evil. This is something that is said by so many people, and they think just the fact of living every day is an evil thing. That is absolutely wrong. Just because you're living and enjoying life does not mean you're living in sin. Okay, so there are certain things that God has designed that are designed to make man feel pleasure. And it's said like this, appropriate pleasure, okay? So understand, all right? But this is the thing. God says if you don't do those things, then you'll be punished because you didn't use my gifts, okay? So the idea is that God, the reason he created all of creation was so that he could pour his love out on something other than himself. And so that's why God has created you, because the idea is that he wants to show you that he loves you, okay? So as we try to elevate ourselves, everything that we learn to do in the process is a process of stripping away one of those veils. So we say the lowest veil is, and the one that obscures the light to the greatest amount is the flesh, is the physical part, okay? And that's just because this veil of flesh is here, and if we think in terms of everything is physical. You know, life is physical. That's what it is. And we don't even give time to think that God is spiritual, and to have a relationship with him is a spiritual thing, okay? Think of spiritual and spirituality as a gigantic magnet, okay? So you have a piece of magnetism, let's say, inside of you because you have spirit inside of you. And then God has a force that he calls spiritual, and it's a magnet. So from wherever you're at to wherever God's at, it's drawing you ever closer to God. The magnet, once it comes into range of the other magnet, then the force is being pulling the two magnets together. But you can understand that somebody that understands this, you can put them close enough that they'll influence one another, but they won't immediately attract to one another. But more often than not, once you get them into the field where the field of magnetism begins to work, you got to hold them, right? Because if you don't hold them back, then they're going to snap together, okay? So, it's a spiritual principle, okay? So, in other words, what happens is there are things in life that do what? They hold us back from just the release of the magnet, and then it comes together and it snaps together. But at the same time, if you were to take those two magnets and you put them close or within the proximity of one another, what's going to happen is they're going to start the process of drawing close together. But there's always something else that happens that's also a spiritual principle. And that is what?
If you turn them the other way, they'll push each other apart.
They always have to be correctly oriented. And once you put those magnets within the realm of one another, what happens is the side that is attracted to the opposite side, which is, it's not a negative. In spirituality, it's not a negativity. It's just the other side of spirituality, and that is a greater level, okay? So what happens is you have two magnets. They come toward one another, and then no matter what happens, they flip, they turn, they whatever, to orient themselves so that they'll come together, okay? And this is, again, the idea of another veil. It has to be oriented in the appropriate direction and in the appropriate way for it to connect with, you know, with God, okay? So with God, spirituality is a gigantic magnet that draws you closer to God. And so you always feel it. You do not realize it, but it's always there and it's always working. And it's always trying to draw you into the divine presence. Now, the closer you get, the easier it is. Why? To flip, but the easier it is to get into the close proximity of God, because the spiritual force does it by itself. All you have to do is implement the program. Okay, so look at when you're driving your car or a car, whatever, you put your foot on the gas and it starts going. You can let your foot off of the gas and it's still going to keep going. Okay. But what's going to happen is eventually it's going to, you know, stop, okay? And those are laws. They're not just, you know, physical law. They're also spiritual laws, okay? So in the same thing is in relationship to spirituality. So if you think of yourself as being inside of a spiritual vehicle, you give the vehicle gas and you're going to go toward God, okay? Let your foot off the gas, it slows down, and you don't achieve the mark. You don't achieve the point that you're going to make with God. So, in other words, spirituality needs maintenance, and it needs to be maintained so that you will get closer. The idea is to remove the resistance. Okay, a car has built-in resistance. What are all the resistance?
Brakes and friction.
Brakes, friction, but just even without the brakes, brakes are in use of an intentional stop, but the car has built-in resistance. You know, it sits on bearings and all of these different things for the wheels and all of the drivetrain that goes through the engine, and all of that stuff has a method, a process of retarding, you know, the positive movement of the car. But the less resistance that the car has against its motion, the easier it will go. The easier,
and the faster.
And the greater the speed. And there's one thing else we really consider a lot today. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So there's a little cough there.
Okay, so we're at the end of our discussion, and I didn't even get the first way. But nevertheless, the idea, now you can see. And you think of these things, these are not things that are absolute mechanical, but you need to look at them from a spiritual perspective and say, okay, what are the things that are causing friction in me moving toward closer to God? How can I get rid of them? What are they? Et cetera, et cetera. And many of them are your, you know, things that you do in your physical body, etc. Okay? But again, that's not a negativity. That's
not even necessarily a sin. You're not
it's, doing yeah, it's it. Not a I'm not speaking of sin in the, you know, in the simplest I'm just saying that there are things that we can do. Look at, you know, instead of devoting yourself to a time of service with God, you go on and you just go about your day and you don't even think about God. That's resistance against spiritual magnetism. Okay?